Hello and welcome to this brand new episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales. As usual, we'll stick with the same format. First there'll be the story, then some information about the story and the folklore involved in it. After that, we'll talk about today's food and the history, and then there'll be today's recipe. Our story today is the Black Bull of Norroway. I've adapted it from the version in Joseph Jacobs' More English Fairy Tales. Well, I'll speak a bit more about that afterwards, but for now, are you listening comfortably, gentle listener? Then I'll begin. In Norway, a long time ago, there lived a certain lady, and she had three daughters. They were all beautiful of face, but only the youngest had beauty of mind and spirit. They had reached the age when they were starting to look about them for husbands, and seeing few candidates close by were discussing what was to do. The eldest said she would seek her fortune elsewhere, but she wasn't going to settle for anything less than an earl. She had plans, she said, and didn't want to waste her beauty on an ordinary poor man. So she went to her mother. Mother, bake me a bannock and roast me a collop, for I'm going away to seek my fortune. Her mother did so, and the daughter went away to an old witch watchwife and told her purpose. The old wife bade her stay that day and look out of her back door and see what she could see. She saw nothing the first day. The second day she did the same and saw nothing again. On the third day she looked again and saw a beautiful coach with six matched bays coming along the road. She ran in and told the old wife what she saw. Well, said the old woman, that's for you. So they took her into the coach and galloped off. Some time passed and the second daughter decided to try her fortune like her elder sister. She said she wasn't going to settle for anything less than a baron. She had plans, she said, and she didn't want to waste her beauty on an ordinary poor man. The second daughter said to her mother, Mother, bake me a bannock and roast me a collop, for I'm going away to seek my fortune. Her mother did so, and away she went to the old wife as her sister had done. On the third day she looked out of the back door and saw a beautiful coach with four matched greys this time coming along the road. Well, quoth the old woman, yon's for you. So they took her in and off they set. More time passed, and the youngest and loveliest of the daughters, in both mind, body and spirit, decided to try her fortune. So she went to her mother and said, Mother, bake me a bannock and roast me a collop, for I'm going away to seek my fortune. Her mother was reluctant, as she was her favourite, and she didn't really want to let her go. However, the youngest daughter begged and said that she was only looking for a man that would make her happy. So her mother did so, and away she went to the old witch. She bade her look out of her back door and see what she could see. She did so, and when she came back, she said she saw nothing. The second day she did the same and saw nothing. The third day she looked again, and on coming back said to the old wife that she saw nothing but a great black bull coming crooning along the road. Well, quoth the old witch, yon's for you. On hearing this she was next to distracted with grief and terror, but the bull stood as still as a lamb for her to mount, and then at a gentle pace he set off. The girl had no need to catch hold of his horns to keep herself from falling, his step was so even. Aye, they travelled, and on they travelled. The sun rose high in the heavens and poured down on the girl's uncovered head the full heat of his rays. But just as he began to feel it painfully, they entered a forest, where the green shade of summer trees made a pleasant shelter. And when they came out from the forest again on the other side, the sun was declining, and before long he had sunk below the horizon, and evening was at hand. The youngest daughter, who was named Aoife, was feeling faint from hunger, as a collop and a bannock won't keep a girl forever. Eat out of my right ear, said the black bull, and drink out of my left ear. So she did as he said, and was wonderfully refreshed. And long they rode, and hard they rode, through the dark, till they came in sight of a very big and bonny castle. Yonder we must be this night, quoth the bull, for my old brother lives yonder, and presently they are at the place. They lifted her off his back, and took her in, and sent her away to a park for the night. In the morning, when they brought the bull home, they took the lady into a fine, shining parlour, and gave her a beautiful apple, telling her not to break it till she was in the greatest strait ever mortal was in the world, and that would bring her out of it. Again, she was lifted on the bull's back, but she was now getting accustomed to his strange steed, and felt less tired and frightened, and when the sun grew hot, the bull was sure to find a sheltered path, where the trees shaded her from the glare, and when the road was rough, he went even more slowly, so she would not be shaken. And after she had ridden far, and farther than I can tell, they came in sight of a far bonnier castle, and further away than the last. So, said the bull to her, yonder we must be this night, for my second brother lives yonder. And they were at the place directly. They lifted her down and took her in, and sent the bull to the field for the night. In the morning, they took the lady into a fine and rich room and gave her the finest pear she had ever seen, bidding her not to break it until she was in the greatest strait ever mortal could be in, and that would get her out of it. Again, she was lifted and set on his back, and away they went. And long they rode, and hard they rode, till they came in sight of a far biggest castle, and the furthest away that they had yet seen. "We must be yonder tonight," said the bull, "for my younger brother lives yonder." And they were there directly. They lifted her down, took her in, and sent the bull to the field for the night. In the morning they took her into a room, the finest of all she'd been in, and gave her a plum, telling her not to break it until she was in the greatest strait mortal could be in, and that would get her out of it. Presently they brought home the bull, set the lady on his back, and away they went. And aye they rode, and on they rode, till they came to a dark and ugsome glen, where they stopped, and the lady lighted down. Said the bull to her, "Here you must stay until I go and fight the devil. You must seat yourself on that stone, and move neither hand nor foot till I come back, else I'll never find you again, and our only hope will be if you seek me beyond the sea of ice and the hill of glass. And if everything round you turns blue, I've beaten the old one. But should all things turn red, he'll have conquered me." She set herself down on the stone, and by and by all around her turned blue. Overcome with joy, she lifted one of her feet and crossed it over the other. So glad was she that her companion was victorious. The bull returned and sought for her, but never could find her. And long she sat, and long she wept, waiting for the bull, and eventually she realised that he was not returning. "Seek me beyond the sea of ice and the hill of glass," the bull had said. So she rose up to begin her journey. She had to walk many weary miles across the moor, the cold wind blowing in her face, the rough ground pricking her tender feet, but she walked on and on till at last the morning broke and she saw a road before her, bordered on one side by a forest of trees, for she had reached the extreme edge of the moor. She had gone but a little way when she came to a small and miserable hovel, from which issued feeble sounds of distress. Aoife went up to the door and looked in. A very old woman sat huddled up in a corner, weeping and lamenting herself. "What's the matter, my friend?" asked Aoife. "Matter enough," replied the old woman. "I cannot light my fire, and I'm bitterly cold. Either the sticks are wet, or the strength has gone out of my poor old arms." "Let me help you," said Aoife. "My arms are strong enough." She took the sticks and arranged them cleverly in the fireplace. She picked up two of the dries to rub together to get a light. A spark appeared instantly, and immediately a bright flame danced up the chimney. The old woman came near to the fire and stretched out her withered hands to the blaze. "What can I do for you, my pretty lady," she said, "in return for your good nature?" "Give me a cup of milk to refresh me for my journey," said Aoife. "And perhaps, too, you can tell me of something about my journey. Are the sea of ice and the hill of glass anywhere in this neighbourhood?" The old woman smiled and nodded her head two or three times. 7 days you must travel," she said, "before you see them. At the foot of the hill of glass lies the sea of ice. No mortal foot unaided has ever crossed the one or ascended the other. Here, take these shoes. With them you can safely walk over the sea of ice." And as she spoke, she handed Aoife a pair of curiously carved wooden shoes. Aoife took them gratefully and would have thanked the old woman, whom she now knew to be a fairy. But the old lady held up a hand, for as everyone knows, you must never thank the fair folk directly. "Think not," she said, "that your difficulties will be over when you have reached the summit of the hill of glass, for all I can do for you more is remind you of the apple you carry, which you must open in your moment of greatest need." Aoife realised that the fairy had not told her how to climb the hill of glass, and turned to ask, but the woman had disappeared. It would be impossible to describe all she went through during the 7 days which passed before she reached the sea of ice. She saw some strange and wonderful sights, for in those days the world was very different from what it is now. She was often tired and hungry, thankful for a cup of milk or crust of bread from those she happened to meet on the way. But her courage never failed her, and at last, on the morning of the 8th day, she saw shining before her in the sunlight the great silent sea of ice of which she had been told. It would have been hopeless to attempt to cross it without fairy aid, for its surface was slicker than any mirror, and so hard that no young woman's bones could have borne a fall on its cruel surface. But with the magic shoes there was less than no difficulty, for no sooner had Aoife slipped her feet into them than they changed, for they possessed the power of enabling their wearer to glide along with the greatest swiftness. Aoife had never skated in her life, and she was delighted. Next to flying, she said to herself, nothing could be pleasanter, and she was almost sorry when her skim across the sea of ice was over and she found herself at the foot of the hill of glass. She looked upwards with something like despair. It was a terrible ascent to attempt, for the mountain was all but straight, so steep were its sides of hard, clear, sparkling glass. Aoife looked at her feet. The magic shoes had already disappeared. Round the bottom of the hill she went, looking everywhere for the tiniest crack to start her attempt. To climb, finding nothing, till at last she came to a smith's house, and the smith promised, if she would serve him for 7 years, he would make her iron shoes, wherever she could climb over the glassy hill. At 7 years' end she got her iron shoes, and the smith's granny told her to remember the pair that she had been given 7 long years before, and that she should use it in her hour of greatest need. She stepped forward bravely. It took a long time, even though she had the iron shoes, and by the time she reached the top of the hill, night had fallen, and but for the light of the stars, she would not have known where to step. A long plain stretched before her. No trees or bushes even broke the wide expanse. There was no shelter of any kind, and Aoife found herself obliged to walk on and on, for the wind was very cold, and she dared not let herself rest. This night and the next day were the hardest part of all the journey, even counting the 7 years with the smith, and seemed even more so because Aoife had hoped that the sea of ice and the hill of glass were to be the worst of her difficulties. She walked on and on, though nearly dead with cold and fatigue, till late in the afternoon. Then at last, far before her still, she saw gleaming the lights of a town, and, encouraged by the sight, she gathered her courage together and pressed on till, at the door of a little cottage at the outskirts of the town, she sank down with fatigue. An old woman, with a kind face, came out of the house and invited her to enter and rest. "You look sorely tired, my child. Have you travelled far?" "Ah, yes," replied the poor Aoife, "very far. I am nearly dead with fatigue." And indeed she looked very miserable. Her beautiful hair was all tumbled and soiled, her poor little feet were scratched and blistered, her black dress torn and draggled. She looked more like a beggar maiden than the beautiful girl that had set out so long ago. But yet her pretty way of speaking, and gentle manners, showed she was not what she seemed, and when she had washed her face and combed her hair, the old woman looked at her with admiration. "'Tis a pity you have not a better dress," she said, "for then you could have gone with me to see the rejoicings in the town for the marriage of our prince." "Is your prince to be married today?" asked Aoife. No, not today, tomorrow," said the old woman. "But the strange thing is that he has not yet known who to be his bride. The prince has only lately returned to his home, for many years he has been transformed by a spell, and now the spell is broken, he is restored to his parents. They are anxious to see him married. But he must still be under a spell of some kind, they say, for though he has all that heart can wish, he is ever sad and silent, as if he were thinking of something far away. He has refused to be married for 7 years and 7 days, but now he has agreed to marry the maiden who can wash the blood from his pure white shirt. Several have tried, but so far no one has succeeded." The old woman went off to town for the continuing celebrations, after reminding Aoife to think of the plum that she had been given. Aoife headed towards the palace laundry, and who should you find but the witch washerwoman who had sent her on her adventure, and her daughter. The old wife had washed till she was tired, and then she set her daughter at it, and both washed, and they washed, and they washed, and they were professional washerwomen, in hopes of getting at the prince, but all they could do, they couldn't bring out the stain. At length they set Aoife to work, and whenever she began, the stains came out pure and clean. She was exhausted and fell asleep whilst waiting for the shirt to dry, and the old woman made the prince believe it was her daughter who had washed the shirt. There was great rejoicing, and the wedding was set for the next day. When Aoife awoke, she fell into despair, thinking all was lost, but suddenly she thought of her apple, and breaking it, found it filled with gold and precious jewellery, the richest she had ever seen. "All these," she said to the washerwife's daughter, "I will give you, on condition that you put off your marriage for one day, and allow me to go into the prince's room alone at night." So the lady consented, but meanwhile the old wife had prepared a sleeping drink and given it to the prince, who drank it, and never awakened till the next morning. The lifelong night, Aoife sobbed and sang, 7 long years I served for thee, the glassy hill I climbed for thee, thy bloody clothes I rang for thee, and wilt thou not waken and turn to me? Next day, she knew not what to do for grief. But then she remembered the pear and broke it and found it filled with jewellery even far richer than the contents of the apple. With these jewels, she bargained for permission to be a second night in the young prince's chamber. But the old wife gave him another sleeping drink, and he again slept till morning. All night she kept singing and sighing as before. 7 long years I served for thee, the glassy hill I climbed for thee, thy bloody clothes I rang for thee, wilt thou not waken and turn to me? When the prince was dressing the next day, his man asked him what the strange singing and moaning that had been heard in his room for 2 nights meant. I heard nothing, said the prince. It must have been your fancy. Said the man. Take no sleeping drink tonight, and be sure to lay aside your pillow of heaviness. And you will also hear for what 2 nights has kept me awake. That being the 3rd night, and Aoife being between hope and despair, she broke her plum, and it held by far the richest jewellery of the 3. She bargained as before, and the old wife, as before, took in the sleeping drink to the prince's chamber. But he told her he couldn't drink it that night without sweetening, and when she went away for some honey to sweeten it with, he poured out the drink, and so made the old wife think he had drunk it. They all went to bed again, and Aoife began as before, singing, 7 long years I served for thee, the glassy hill I climbed for thee, thy bloody clothes I rang for thee, wilt thou not waken and turn to me? He heard, and turned to her, and she told him all that had befallen her, and he told her all that had happened to him. Aoife, happy to be the instrument of his second deliverance, consented to marry him, and the witch washerwife, with her daughter, fled the country, afraid of the prince's anger, and has never since been heard of. All was again hurry and preparation in the castle, and the marriage which now took place at once ended the adventures of the Black Bull of Norroway and the wanderings of Aoife, and he and she are living happy to this day, for all I know. And that, gentle listener, is the end of my tale, and I hope it pleased you, for it had no other purpose. So, what did you think? This came, as I mentioned, from More English Fairy Tales by Joseph Jacobs, but in reality this is a Scottish tale. The version from Andrew Lang's fairy book is written much more in dialect. There are also 2 stories of the Bull of Norroway, one black, one red. One that involves the daughters of what we must assume is not a wealthy woman, if only from the choices of snack and necessity to seek their fortune. The other, the Red Bull, one involves the daughters of a king. They share many similarities, and indeed I've borrowed some elements from this and a 19th century literary version of this tale to flesh out the story a little. The Red Bull and the Black Bull stories are definitely from the same root. But where did the story come from? It's said by Richard Chambers to be mentioned in the Complaint of Scotland in 1598, and is mentioned by John Leedon in the Court of Kildare. And many a hunting song they sung, a song of game and glee, then tuned to plaintive strains their tongue, of Scotland's love and lee. To wilder measures next they turned, the black, black bull of Norroway. Suddenly the tapers ceased to burn, the minstrels ceased to play. From the Coot of Kildare by John Leedon. It certainly has the feel of an old story, and perhaps that's unsurprising when the tale type it comes from, the ATU-425 Search for a Lost Husband, can be identified as far back as the ancient Greeks in Cupid and Psyche. In this tale type, the woman in the tale is often kidnapped by an enchanted beast, falls in love, and then because of some often small infraction she causes, ensures that her beloved will then disappear, and she must go on a long and arduous journey to get him back. She's usually aided by women or others helpers on the way who give her gifts to help overcome further trials at the end of her journey. There's quite often shirt washing, mending or making involved. The most famous of the Lost Husband tales in Western Europe is probably East of the Sun and West of the Moon, which features a prince that's been transformed into a white bear. It contains a scene that our tale does not, that of taking advice from family to find out more about the husband in question, thus leading to betrayal and continuing enchantment. This is noticeably missing from our tale, where a heroine just moves her foot and is then punished with hard work and a long and difficult journey. The other thing missing from our story is any retribution dealt out to our heroine's older sisters. As pride usually goes before a fall, especially for women, you would expect 2 beautiful but not nice women who insisted on marrying above their station and according to their own wishes to be punished. But no, they get their earl and their baron and their horses and their carriages and they're never heard from again. I know that I said we would have a rest from Giambattista Basile, but he has a story of the same tale type, which is perhaps a little more uplifting. In Basile's tale, a wealthy young merchant's daughter refuses to marry everyone brought before her and instead makes her own husband from sugar, rose water and ground almonds and prays to the goddess of love to turn her sugar figure into a real man. Her incredibly handsome husband is stolen from her by a great queen and she proceeds in search of him all the while whilst going increasingly more pregnant. She's given 3 enchantments by her helper and uses them to create wonderful items she trades the queen for nights with her husband. There's no washing here. And eventually, when she breaks the spell, she and her husband steal back her wonderful items and all the money and jewels of the false bride and escape to a wonderful life, after first resting for her to have the baby. The queen essentially explodes in anger when she finds out. And then all is well. What makes these tales 425A not just the obvious is the heroine usually uses gifts provided by helpers along the way to bribe her lover's new bride-to-be to enable her to spend the night with him. This is very different for 425C, for example, where the bridegroom in question suffers illness and death because his beloved does not return to him as promised. You'll recognise the most famous example as Beauty and the Beast. But our tale type 425A also usually features a false bride who either enchants or fools the hero of the tale into thinking she's his true bride by using the work of an original beloved, she shirt washing as mentioned previously. The false bride is another tale type we discussed at length in the Two Little Pizzas episode. There's even a crossover with a Cinderella variant, as identified by Marion Ralph Crox in her book Cinderella, 345 Variants of Cinderella, Catskin and Kappa Rushes from 1893. She specifically states that this tale has won several points of resemblance to Cinderella tales. She also references the Red Bull of Norway. These tales are very much women's tales and are told by mothers to their daughters so that they might not be afraid of husbands that were much older than them or not as handsome as they might prefer. They were to reassure as well as to help young women understand their place in society and what might happen to them if they behaved in a way that did not fit their patriarchal society. The heroines in these stories were punished for the slightest infraction of the rules, and it was understood that young women might face punishments from society if they stepped over the line of what was considered pleasing. This has also been identified in similar Indian tales by A.K. Ramanujan. Tales told by women, about women, and often to younger women, in which saving, rescuing, or reviving a man, often solving riddles on his behalf, becomes the life task of the heroine. In such tales, women predominate. The antagonists are usually women, and her chief helpers also tend to be women. Ramanujan also notes that marriage begins rather than ends the story, a separation ensues, and the rescue of the male by the female. The protagonists in these stories, and Ramanujan continues, are true cousins of the feisty heroines in Shakespeare's comedies that owe their plots to the Italian novellas, which are in turn related to tales in the Arabian Nights and the Cathartic Sagad. We are unusually also getting these tales from a women's perspective. As Karen Bamford says in her article, Foreign Affairs, The Search for the Lost Husband in Shakespeare's All's Well That Ends Well, since it is a woman-centred tale, we see things from the heroine's point of view. Thus, her husband is both beast and god, monstrous and beautiful, frightening and desirable. There is a lot more we could say on this, but I think it makes for a very long podcast, and there are people who definitely know what they're talking about and would say it better. There are links to both Karen Bamford and A.K. Ramanujan in the further reading section, which we reach from the show notes. Instead of focusing on the folklore and the story itself this week, we're going to take a look at the folklore of the ingredient rather than the story, because it has a folklore tale all to itself. Also, I suspect the folklore of numbers, which comes up regularly through our tale, is too big for this episode. What would you say if I said, eating up ingredients before Lent is not just about Pancake Day, or Shrove Tuesday, it's more properly known. Obviously, Shrove Tuesday is the star now. Everyone loves a pancake. They can be adapted for all diets, although I admit tricky if both vegan and gluten-free. They can be sweet or savoury or even stuffed or layered and mean you can have fun showing off in the kitchen. Shrove Tuesday is all about the drama of a good flip. It's sadly overtaken our other using up ingredients day as it's flashy and crowd pleasing, whereas Collop Monday is all about eating up meat. More sturdy and filling, but less inclusive. Collops were slices of meat, often bacon, fried and served usually with eggs on this day. Collop Monday took place on the Monday before Ash Wednesday, and the resulting bacon fat was often used to fry the pancakes for Shrove Tuesday, according to some sources. It was popular in Tudor England and probably started in medieval times when the meat prohibition during Lent was taken significantly more seriously. It had virtually disappeared by the end of the 19th century, and in some locations pennies were given to children on this day instead, and they'd buy sweets with the money. There is some disagreement whether the day got its name because people were eating collops, or whether they were cutting up their meat into collops to salt and preserve their meat during Lent, or even both. It's a tricky one because I don't know enough about preserving meat in salt without refrigeration, but as bacon is already salted, I'm going to go towards the edge of eating it. That leads us onto the dish itself, if it can be called that. There's some discussion over whether the word for collops is connected to the French word escalope, and the general response is maybe, maybe not, and then maybe. The only thing we can say is it isn't connected to the word scallop, as in the seafood item, although Hannah Glass did cause some confusion over this with her recipe for oyster collops, which in this case just meant served in scallop shells. Collops in their simplest form are slices of meat fried and often served with eggs. Bacon's most popular here. There are lots of recipes for collops, though, that involve a lot more fancy cooking and ingredients, including mushroom gravy and squeezes of citrus fruit. Sometimes the collops are stuffed with herbs and other ingredients and rolled and fried. Gravy seems to be very popular, especially made with oysters and anchovies, and then the resulting meat slices and the gravy are served over hot toasts. Some seem to prefer the serving of plain fried collops with vinegar or pickles, some preferring a simple sauce with pickled walnuts, capers and gherkins. A richer wine-based gravy, perhaps with added cream, seems to be the favourite of Hannah Glass. Scotch collops seem to be a specific variation, with veal cut thin and then fried crisp, then served in a thick gravy made from the pan in which the veal was cooked. Forcemeat balls were then often added to the gravy, along with mushrooms and bacon. Some recipes from E. Smith and Elizabeth Raffold contain more exotic additional ingredients like oysters, artichoke bottoms, lemon slices, sweetbreads, lemon pickle, mushroom ketchup, caper liquor, cayenne pepper, barberries and kidney beans. Elizabeth Raffold has three different recipes for Scotch collops, one brown, one white, one the French way. Margaret Dodd's book published in Edinburgh suggests that Scotch collops were actually so called because they were scotched or scored collops, not specifically Scottish in nature. She does, however, consider venison collops to be a Scottish dish, though, in particular calling minced collops a national dish. Her recipe for Scottish minced collops with minced beef fried with butter and stock until cooked. The serving suggestions include shred onions, pickles or vinegars, plain or flavoured. She also suggests they will keep some time if packed in a can and covered like potted meats. I'm not sure if I fancy that, but it does seem to have been popular. Collop also seems to refer to slices of potato battered or covered in flour and fried in the north of England, so there is a vegetarian version you could have on Collop Monday. I'm going to share another Black Country Birmingham story with you now. When I was young, my friends and I used to get one or two scallops from the chip shop and sit and eat them out of the paper. Doesn't that sound fancy? I imagine in this case you've worked out that they were battered slices of potato, not the fancier seafood version, which I didn't actually realise was a thing until my teens. There's no proof of this, but I'm going to take a huge leap and suggest that there is a connection between these scallops and the northern potato collops I've just mentioned. There is a scallop line, as suggested by Howard Wilkinson on the blog Paradise Circus. The suggestion is that the West Midlands Combined Authority should actually only cover the area defined by the question, where do you get potato in batter if you ask for scallops at the chippy? Sadly, no one has taken him up on the idea, even after actual research, well, in the form of a Google Doc. Although there is a definite similarity, we do seem to lose a lot of Shropshire and a big chunk of Coventry and Warwickshire. It just goes to show that even Brummies take scallops, or collops, very seriously still. You can take part in the research if you like. It's a little bit out of date now, but it is fun and will occupy you briefly. The link is available on the show notes. Now, to the recipe, for want of a better word. You remember the cheese sandwich one? Well, this is actually better, because I'm going to give you a link to the most wonderful sandwich loaf by the fabulous Nigella. It's a bit different, but don't let that put you off. Obviously, you could just buy a sliced loaf, but it needs to be soft bread. Sourdough isn't right here. Now, for the sandwich part. I'm going to use bacon, because it seems to be the most common collop. This recipe is for one, but can be scaled up. It's probably best if you're feeling slightly less than your best, after a little too much indulgence the night before. It should be served with tea so strong you can stand your spoon up in it. The bacon should ideally be smoked back bacon, or even the vegetarian one. It may go without saying that if you can afford to spend more on high welfare meat, you'll get a better flavour as well as a slightly eased conscience. The mushrooms don't need to be special, but I just strangely like the chestnut ones, as I think the colour makes them taste nicer. It's probably rubbish. The cheese should be mature cheddar, but any melty tasty cheese will do, even a vegan one. The barbecue sauce is controversial here, but I love the sweet spiciness. You could use brown sauce, or HP, or HP fruity. Ketchup's possible, but it'd be a terrible shame. It has too much uncomplicated sweetness here. My choice of mayo is any good Polish one, if you can get it. If you'd like further instructions on how to put that sandwich together, you can find the recipe link in the show notes as normal. I think that's about all for today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. It's been lovely to have you with me. And I hope you'll join me again for the next episode of Folklore, Food and Fairy Tales.